ditch the balcony and join us at the drive-in. This is Art House Summer. I'm the movie dude Eric, but you can call me Full Metal Bitch.
I'm Chris Tonwald.
I'm Beef. You can find me on Legends Podcast as a host of others.
And in this episode, we're discussing Live, Die, Repeat, also known as Edge of Tomorrow, starring Tom Cruise, Emily Blunt, Bill Paxton, Brendan Gleeson, and Noah Taylor, directed by Doug Liman. So, gentlemen, we are talking about a movie that technically is a box office bomb. This movie failed spectacularly at the box office, yet we are still talking about this movie as an art house summer flick. Because I honestly feel, and I think everyone that discusses this movie understands that this movie should not have failed at the box office. This movie had two spectacularly bad things happen that kept it from being able to succeed. The first is one of the worst publicity campaigns, marketing campaigns of all time. This is one of the worst marketed movies ever made. And it had one of the worst titles for an action movie. Is there anyone that's going to disagree on this one?
The marketing just didn't know what it wanted to be. I mean, you know, Edge of Tomorrow, I think that's, you know, when I saw it in the theaters, and then they rebranded it because it, I mean, it's, the trailers were good from what I remember. I was going to rewatch one of the old ones, but I didn't. But the trailers were good. It caught my attention to go see it, but no one else did.
Yeah, I don't even remember the marketing. I think the title is okay. Edge of Tomorrow is fine. But I do remember there was a huge disconnect between what everybody was saying about the movie, like how good the movie was, to just people actually showing up to the theater.
And I think for me, what it comes down to, because when I watched the trailers for Live, Die, Repeat, first off, I felt like this was a gimmick, right? Because basically what this ultimately is Groundhog Day in an action cyberpunk sci-fi movie, right? I mean, that if you really wanted to be completely disingenuous, if you just want to
I guess if you boil it down to its basic bare minimum, but it gets to be so much deeper than that by the end.
Right.
That's true. But the trailers and the and the marketing specifically made that reference. They made sure that it kind of gave you that, it's Groundhog Day. It's Groundhog Day. But you add on top of that a title that was vague at best. When I think of Edge of Tomorrow, I'm thinking about maybe some sort of inspirational drama. It doesn't have an action beat to it. Now, understand that the original title for this is because it's based on a Japanese manga, if I'm not correct.
Yeah, but that's all you need is all you need is kill.
Yeah, I'll be honest here. I feel like that title would not have been any better because first off, people are going to associate this with basically like a Beatles sidetrack a little bit. But I gotta say, though, this is one of those weird things where the catchphrase was a better title than the actual title. Because I remember the catchphrase, and everyone remembers the catchphrase. In fact, again, talking about the stupid marketing, they made the catchphrase bigger than the title on the posters and on the marketing materials, to the point where people were looking for this movie called Live, Die, Repeat, not realizing that wasn't the title of the movie.
I don't know. I can't remember. I want to say that it almost released in theaters with Edge of Tomorrow, and then they started pumping it up to Live, Die, Repeat, and it was a horrible shit show.
No, Live, Die, Repeat became the official title after it dropped on DVD. That was...
Right, okay.
during the DVD when they when it came to DVD, that was when they adopted Live Die Repeat as the unofficial.
Which is kind of stupid because if you liked it as Edge of Tomorrow, now you're looking for it to buy it, and then you're like, "What the fuck?" I back to your thing. I think I liked Edge of Tomorrow because for me it was a time travel and all that kind of shit. Edge of Tomorrow. Once I saw one trailer, I knew it was Groundhog Day in fucking space. I didn't need them to say that, you know.
But, all right, so, so Beef, you said that you saw this in theaters, right?
Correct.
And so, what was your initial impression going to the theaters? And how many people were in the theater with you? Because, again, this was a notorious bomb. So I'm curious as to, was it half full? Was it totally full? Was it only, like, you and three other people?
To be honest, I don't really know. And I go to movies at stupid times anyways, like 2 p.m. or stuff like that. So I don't... there aren't usually a lot of people when I go. And I think I just remember being excited because Oblivion came out maybe 6 months or 8 months earlier and I had a riot with that. So why the hell not go see this one? And I really enjoyed this one as well. I mean, it, I don't know. They both kind of revitalized Tom Cruise for me in being able to do action again, even though he never fell off with Mission Impossible, but this movie was fresh. Live, Die, Repeat, Edge of Tomorrow. It was what we'd seen, but it was still fun and different, and it was heartfelt because it wasn't just him killing himself because he got sick of the day. He was dying to try to fight and save, and I don't know. I just got done watching it again, so I'm all like, ah.
Well, yeah, we're gonna get into this because there's a lot to talk about this. But Chris, what was your first time with this movie, or was it for this particular podcast?
I don't remember if I saw it in the theaters, but I definitely remember there being a lot of word of mouth buzz for it, and the same kind of conversation about the marketing being terrible in my group of friends, but the movie being so good that you have to watch it. And for me, I remember watching this movie and just being like, this is amazing. He needs to do way more stuff with like this. And then that actually got me into Rogue Nation, which was the Mission Impossible movie like right after this. And okay. I was like, oh, yeah, this is great. Like, I like him in this. And then I distinctly remember watching Oblivion either in between those two, or maybe like after watching those two and being like, this is terrible. Like, I get the whole kind of like baseball thing that he has going on and all the sci-fi about it. But overall, I was just like, I need him to just do all the action stuff and he'll never age ever.
No, he's a robot.
Yeah. So it's even better for me, the fact that he's indestructible and immortal. So that's what I think about with movies like this, where no matter what happens to him, he's going to find a way to survive and keep going. And just like Edge of Tomorrow, Live, Die, Repeat, whatever, you know, that it just kind of sums up every aspect of the action and the sci-fi stuff that he does, because he does a lot of different sci-fi stuff. Oblivion, Minority Report, you know, and I think it's great that he's able to kind of be a sci-fi action star.
At like 54 or however old he is.
Yeah. All right. So I want to tie this into last week's episode. So you're saying that he's a mummy? Huh?
No. No.
Oh, okay. The new mummy? That was so bad.
It was. No, we last week we talked about the 99 mummy. And okay. We kind of brought up all the other mummies too, so... tying it back into that. But okay, so I'll be honest here. So I've been following Tom Cruise basically since Top Gun. Top Gun was my first Tom Cruise movie. As Beef knows from my multiple times at Legends Podcast, whenever a new Mission Impossible comes out, I am a huge fanboy for Mission Impossible. So I've been following Tom Cruise for as long as I can remember being a movie fan. That said, though, there was a time when Tom Cruise lost his edge, and it came ultimately just after Mission Impossible 3, or I guess you could say it was around the time of well, Mission Impossible 3 and War of the Worlds, when he went off the deep end with Scientology and Katie Holmes and the couch jumping and stuff like that. And he actually became toxic for a few years. And then he did a little movie called Valkyrie and Tropic Thunder, which kind of brought him back into the attention. And then he did Ghost Protocol, which was technically supposed to be his last Mission Impossible because he was going to hand it off to Hawkeye, but you know that didn't go too well. And then he did a couple of other really bad movies, unless anyone wants to remember Night and Day and Rock of Ages for some reason. Even I'm like shiver at that one.
I did like War of the Worlds though, because him and the young Fanning, if anyone's going to stare at anything and make it look somewhat believable and nothing's there and like emote him and whichever young Fanning was in that at the time, I was like, okay, it's at least acceptable.
That was Ethan Hunt versus the aliens. I'll just put it that way. But going.
Wait, what?
Well, yeah, I mean, how he took out that mothership at the end of War of the Worlds, that was a pure Ethan Hunt move. Ethan Hunt.
I do have to watch it again. I think I only watch it twice, and I just stopped. But okay, sorry.
So while I enjoyed Oblivion, I'll be honest here. When Edge of Tomorrow came out, I was not feeling like that was going to go anywhere. So I actually kind of skipped out on it, especially after people didn't go see it, and I just didn't make an effort to go see it until the critics came out, like when it was leaving theaters. Like, the critics all of a sudden go, what the fuck are you doing? This movie is good. Why are you not going to see it? But by that point, it was too late. That said, though, it came back to the $2 theaters. And that time, I went ahead and go see it. And if you know, the thing about me, though, is I love the prime premium theater experience. I love, you know, the reclinable seats, the subwoofers in the chairs, stuff like that. I love that optimal experience. So seeing it in a $2 theater with sticky floors and ratty seats and stuff like that, you have to understand how dedicated I have to be in order to go to a $2 theater. That is dedication. But so I went and saw it before it left theaters, and I'll be honest here, I was kicking myself. Like, man, what the hell was I thinking? I should have seen this in the optimal seating. I should have been everywhere talking about this movie. I should have put it all over Art House Legends. It was one of those times where I truly felt like I failed as a movie dude, not advertising this movie. But at that same time, I made sure that any time that the conversation ever came across to 2010s action movies, The Raid 2, Live, Die, Repeat. I feel like those are the two that I go to immediately when I think about 2010s action movies. So let's talk about this movie. And we got to talk about the fact that we have Tom Cruise, who apparently is indestructible as he's going into space for this next Mission Impossible. So I don't even know if he even has a helmet. I feel like I would not be surprised if he actually did do a spacewalk.
I don't wear one.
right.
But we also have to talk about Emily Blunt a little bit, because this is her first action role. I mean, and let's be honest here, she hasn't really done a whole lot of action with the exception of Sicario, which is another one of my favorite films of the 2010s, and of course A Quiet Place. But this was her first time really digging into an action role. Out of curiosity, from what you've seen in this movie, does she have action chops? When you're watching here, do you get the idea that she is the Full Metal? I'm not going to say the rest, because obviously she'll beat your ass if you finish that sentence. But do you buy her as that?
I know I do. I don't remember seeing her in any other movie before seeing her in this. And she just kicked all sorts of ass. And then for me, it was a weird thing to see her do like more dramas, because I wanted to see her more into this. Like, I remember her being like cast for Mary Poppins and all that. And I was just like, No, don't do that. Like, beat the kids. I don't need you to like give them spoonfuls of sugar or sing to them. Like, I just want you to kick ass because she's a complete badass in this movie.
Yeah, she most certainly comes off as a badass in this movie, and she either trimmed down or bulked up because you buy her as some soldier or some woman that actually just wants to beat the shit out of these aliens for, you know, just soldiers' sake. I don't know. I believed it. Did you think that she fit well into the action heroine role?
Yeah, you talk about like, did she bulk up? I feel like honestly, the power armor, like I'll be honest here. They made that power armor fit her like a glove because she looked comfortable in the power armor, and apparently she had issues with that power armor. It was pretty heavy from apparently, but she looks natural in it. She looks like she commands it. She looks like whenever you see her fighting in the power armor, she looks
with
like
a fucking sword.
With a Japanese sword. Okay, let's be honest here. That is a Japanese anime Buster sword.
I feel like that is part of a helicopter blade. I think that she, in my mind, she is slicing up those with the mimics with a helicopter blade.
I
like
agree.
During the battle that made her famous, she just ripped off one of those.
Yeah, or her helicopter went down and she's like, screw it, I'm using this.
Yeah, and then she found out she's a complete badass with it, and she's like, well, fuck it. I guess just make me a whole arsenal of just these.
Well, the opening to this movie is the perfect, like, example of an info dump done well.
Preach, brother, preach. I was about to go there. Go, go.
Because you have... Okay, so realistically, the whole setup to the movie starts in the credits and you get all this information and then you have this little snippet with Tom Cruise. Then he's with the general or whatever. Then he's being accosted, waking up, and it's instantly into the movie. Within the first 20 minutes or 15 minutes, I think you hit your first reset already.
Yeah. No, the first reset happens at the 22-minute mark, if I'm not correct. For this podcast, I actually went and was keeping an eye on the pacing. I was curious about how this film paces in regards to how each reset occurs. First off, you get all the backstory in about 4 minutes. Now, I'm going to be honest with you. This is the kind of movie that you don't need a prequel. We'll talk about what might be coming next with this story, but you don't need a prequel. This movie did such a good job establishing everything. Yeah.
Fell to the ground and it kicked our ass.
Yeah. Right.
It kicked our ass, but it also establishes that this is a quick fight. This is not a long, dirty fight. Within basically about a few weeks, Europe is overrun. France is fallen. And we have ourselves kind of a World War II scenario where England is being used as a staging base for an assault, which may or may not be the last stand. And all within the first 5 minutes, you get that information. You also get the information about the Angel of Verdun. You find out about Emily Blunt's character. And you know that, and you know that, that she was a that she did this on her first day. This was her first battle, and
or their first outing in the mech suits or whatever it was.
Yeah, imperfect training. They made it such a big deal out of that imperfect training. Yeah, these suits are so awesome. It wasn't the suits, and that's what I love about this movie is it gives you information and then it builds on that later. So whenever we find out about the fact that yes, she has, she also has the reset. At that particular point, we also realize it's not the suits. She had done this 300, 400, 500 times.
I love the look on her face when he finally like tackles her and kills like three or four mimics without, you know, even looking at them. And he's like, "Come on, we got to go. It's gonna blow up." The way she stares at him for those like 20 seconds there. Is such beautiful shock and awe because you realize that she knows what's up.
Well, yeah, it's perfect.
Well, that's the thing. Emily Blunt is a trained actress. I mean, she is a classically trained actress. And so what they did was, and this is something I gotta love Doug Liman for. Doug Liman has this great way of being able to find actors who are capable of getting range, and then he just throws them through action movie training. He did the same thing for Matt Damon for the Bourne Identity. He did the same thing all the other movies. He does it. He finds a classically trained actor, and he expects them to bring that acting ability, but he also puts them through action school and makes sure that they get the action beats. And I think a lot of that is the fact that he also comes from drama. His first movie was Swingers, for crying out loud. I mean, that is, when you think of Swingers, you're definitely not thinking Bourne Identity or Edge of Tomorrow at all. Just on that. So he has found that kind of groove where he can trust an actress of Emily Blunt's ability and say, okay, you're going to hit these beats, but when you're not hitting these types of beats, you're going to kick so much ass. And I expect you to kick so much ass. And she does. And she feels natural. And you get the sense that she's a genuine badass. She knows how to sell herself as a genuine badass. And that is just something I really love about how this movie sets up. But I also got to talk about this whole Groundhog Day thing. Because there's one thing. Like, I've come to appreciate movies that do the Groundhog Day thing more than Groundhog Day. Like, Happy Death Day, I actually like Happy Death Day because they find the thing that works for Groundhog Day and yet they build on it. It's not the same movie. It's just a different type of look at that same premise. And the same thing can be said about Edge of Tomorrow, right? That it has the patterns that we know from Groundhog Day, but it doesn't play by those same rules. Right? Or do we...
No.
Well, his resets right at the end of every day. I mean, this is just Cage's death.
Yeah. Well, it's Cage's death, but he goes back to a specific point when he gains consciousness, is because he gets knocked out after he tries to blackmail the general, and that's the moment he gains consciousness, and that's where he comes back to. He doesn't go further back in time, with the exception of one. We'll talk about that when we talk about the ending. But that's the moment that he is brought back is when he gains consciousness. And so it establishes that very well. But I also love the fact that it also establishes pretty quickly as well, he's not the only one that this is happening to. So, you know, when we talk about the alphas. So if you kill an alpha, the alpha does the exact same thing he does. And it makes things even worse. So it actually sets up stakes for him to not do certain things or to make sure that he follows a certain set of rules, right?
Yeah.
Clearly. I mean, he does set it up. It's just the rules are defined a lot better than Groundhog Day because you have to play with them more. You have to get shot in the head and learn to train and break your back and get killed and, oh, screw it, I'm tired, let's just start over. I mean, you have to have simple, easy to follow rules because he's going to get shot in the head a lot. And it's funny for a little while, but then you realize he's just watching her die over and over and over, and he's falling in love and he's caring about her. And yeah.
Well, I mean, I'm sorry, go ahead.
I was going to say, it can be gut-wrenching.
Well, I love the fact that he loses hope, I think, twice in the movie. The first time it isn't because he's in love with, because he falls in love. It's just that he feels like he can't do this. He can't win. And so he decides to just skip out and go to England. And he finds out that later that day, the attack fails, They don't even wait a moment. They go straight after London and torch it to the ground. Like, they don't even fucking wait for him. And I love the fact that after that cut, after we know that he dies from that, the first next moment we see, he's thrown himself entirely into his training. Like, he is no longer holding back. He realizes that there is the only hope. There is no other way. He has to do this. And I love the fact that this character has that kind of range, and that Tom Cruise is bringing an acting ability on top of the action that is required of him. And again, I feel like a lot of that has to do with to with Doug Liman's direction, but I also got to give a lot of credit to the writing that was done for this. And I want to say specifically that it would be I forgot the guy's name. The guy who directed the last two Mission Impossible movies, Chris McQuarrie, who also is the screenwriter for those Mission Impossible movies and this one. And so I think Chris McQuarrie knows Tom Cruise so well that he wrote the character to Tom Cruise's strengths specifically. And he was able to kind of find those things he know and develop the character with Tom in mind, because it plays to all of his strengths, right?
Well, you believe him as a weasel in the beginning and then trying to get out of service, and then you believe him actually becoming a reluctant hero.
Well, I still remember him in A Few Good Men, where he pulled the same crap. Or am I the only one that remembers?
No, I've seen it. it's been years.
But I mean, technically he was a lawyer in that, but yeah, he was a weasel in that movie too, just in a different manner. But the thing is that he has that kind of range. Rain Man, he was also an asshole in that movie. He knows how to pull out the asshole when he needs to. And it's awesome that he feels comfortable. It's like he's not, when he pulls out the asshole characters, he doesn't still remind us that he's Tom Cruise. He allows his assholes to be assholes, like genuine, unlikable characters. And I got to ask a question when it comes to this. Did his transformation feel natural to you? Or do you feel that it was kind of forced when we get towards the end?
Well, he dies like 300 times in the story. We only see like 20-something on film. But in the story, he's supposed to die like 250 or 300 times, just like she watched her friend, whatever, die 300 times. Anyone I think would change, especially if they had the weight of the world on their shoulders, whether they're going to pull it off or not, I think they'd try.
Yeah. I mean, if you live and die for 300 times, I mean, there's got to be some kind of character growth with you.
<You'd>
and
then,
right. You know, you're going through these traumatic experiences. I think I enjoyed him going to the bar more so too, the second time that I watched it, because he just looks like defeated. He just looks like this, fuck everything. I don't want to deal with any of this. Like, I hate everything that's happening, because these are terrible things that are happening to him. Mm-hmm. And then that conversation that they end up having with them in the van, I forget the dude's name, Hendrix maybe.
It's Hendrix.
Yeah. Where, you know, she saw him die 300 times in a row and she knows every detail. Like, he's got to be feeling the same thing, and you can see it on his face a little bit. And then he clicks back in because all hell's about to break loose in London. And that just like keeps up with the story and keeps the stakes there. And I just really, really like that too. But yeah, I mean, you there has to be some kind of growth. Like, if I die 300 times, I would expect to be slightly a better person afterwards.
We'd all hope, right?
Right.
The thing that I like is right after all this we're talking about, he's watching her die all these times, and they're at the house. He mends her up, and they have the coffee, and she finds out he has the keys. And then she says, you know, fuck it, and gets in the chopper anyways. The scene after that, when he wakes up again and he's just like, I need 3 extra clips, 8 grenades, and an extra battery. Fuck off. And he does it all by himself. And he finds out that the Omega isn't there. It was all a trap. Like, that is, at that point in time, to me, he has obviously become the hero, because he's like, fuck it, I'm not going to risk her again. And then once he finds out new information, then he has to risk her again.
The cottage was the moment I fell in love with the movie. That scene between Cage and
Blunt.
Between Cage and Blunt, that made me fall in love with it. I was liking it. I was enjoying it. But that scene, the way that it delivers the information to us as the audience, for all we assume, or at least I assume, that this was the first time that they got here.
Right. And then he's calling out how many coffees or sugars she needs.
And
fucker.
As that happens, and you start to realize, as she's realizing, And that's just the power of the two main performances here, how strong they were, not only individually, but together. They were able to keep pace with one another. And that was something that I really appreciate about the performances, specifically these two.
Speaking about pace, though, like there's, you know, all these many little montages where at first they're trying to get off the beach, and they're training. Then she's shooting him in the head all the time. Then they're trying to get off the beach, and he's watching her die all the time. And there's all these different pacings to these montages with little scenes stitched in the middle. And then that's really when they get off that beach. It slows down a little bit because they're in their armor again to get the car. But after that, that's the first time in the movie, really, in like 20 minutes of montages, we've seen them, if not more, out of their battle armor, their mech suits, and actually vulnerable. You know what I mean? So it's like it slows down and you're like, this can't last. This isn't going to last for them.
Well, it also helps. It also helps to be kind of a breathing pace, because just before that was when we had the whole the van and the trailer and that.
You forgot to unhook the RV.
I think
the other thing too, like there's not a whole lot of dialogue and character development because there's so much action, but because we get those beats and we understand what is happening, we can connect with Emily Blunt's character and Tom Cruise's character way more. So even if it's just literally that exchange in the cabin, you know, that's it. That's really the only development that we really need, the only real dialogue relationship that we really need. And just the fact that it's just that little bit of a time where we see that emotional stake in there, be like, we know that there's something more that's going on, and he's trying to be so nice to her and like keep her alive. And she's like,
the fact that it's her first time every day, every scene we see is her like living it all for the first time, and he's growing these feelings for this woman. It's like, fuck.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And the thing is that, one thing, again, you brought this up with the fact that, and I like this about all the actors with the exception of Cruise in this, in regards to they have to keep playing it as this is the first day or second day that they've seen this guy. And they have to keep going back to that every single take no matter how long they've been playing past this character, they have to keep reminding themselves that, you know, this is the first time I met you. And for the most part, they do a really good job. I'm going to say I have one. I don't want to say it's a minor quibble. It's a slightly significant quibble, but it's one that I easily kind of like accept it for what it is. But I got to say that when it comes to Company J and Bill Paxton.
Bill Paxton.
I've even cried on this podcast over Bill Paxton. So I'm trying my hardest not to at this point because I love this man so much. But he kind of those characters, that specific group felt like NPCs at times because he feels like he's on a rote an NPC that is reading out the line that it was given to him. He doesn't feel natural. Like his lines just kind of felt automated. Even when Cage breaks him from his cadence, he goes straight back to it. And like a couple of times it feels natural because, you know, that's his given spiel. But there are several times when he should have just like broken, like, dude, come on. I mean, it just like he goes straight back to the script. Like, To me, it kind of broke my immersion just a little bit, because at that particular point, I'm going, okay, are you an actual human being, or are you just running through are you just running off of a program at that particular point? Is this the Matrix? I mean, are you actually one of the robots in this? And I hate feeling like that because, again, I miss Bill Paxton, and this is fucking Hudson for crying out loud. Okay? Game over, man. I feel like he deserved much better than this. Although he did have one of the greatest lines, which is, "Are you American? No, I'm from Kentucky." You know.
Yeah, no, I'm from Kentucky.
Like, I love that line. But at the same time, though, he felt so much like an NPC at times. And I was like, where's my controller? Like,
well, I think that's kind of the whole bag, you know, of the whole premise of the movie. You know, you're repeating the same mission over and over. Like, if this was an actual game, it would be so annoying to start from the same checkpoint over and over again. But it's, you try different things every time. So you're trying to, like, blast through all these different, like, dialogue options. Like, I've already heard this shit before. I don't care anymore. Let me keep going and going and going. But right, you have to, like, live through it. Yeah. Like, you can't just skip it. It's one of those unskippable cutscenes, you know? Yeah,
and he did skip some of it. I mean, when he would sneak away and go meet her every day, and then some nights he would get caught by them and do the close my eyes fighting thing. I mean, it happened so much that he got his ass kicked so many times there, got into so many fights that he could do it with his eyes closed. And they didn't need to show you that. And you got that. I like that part.
No, it's not about Cage. It's just that the company, all of them felt like NPCs. Not Cage felt developed. It was just because, again, he used the same lines over and over and over again, even after things had changed. After Cage changed something, that at that particular point, his reaction should have been something different. And yet he went straight back to the same line. So it felt like, again, it was like an automated script that he was reading from. Like that scene in Jumanji, you know, the ones with the rock, where the NPC just kept reading the exposition lines without, you know, even no matter what you said to him. It felt the exact same way when it came to, especially Bill Paxton, because he never changed. There was never a beat change with him. He never shifted out of that, out of those lines that he was spewing from the first time around. Whereas maybe a couple of the Company J crew kind of developed a little bit, but not a whole lot, it's okay for the most part. But it felt like it was running off of a program. It felt like it was running off of a video game cut that more than it did like a natural thing that would happen in a story. If that makes any sense.
Yeah, I mean, I get that, but at the same time, like, these are all their natural reactions every single time, because it's this, like, we just talked about it, you know, for her, she's gone through all this. So Emily Blunt's character, she can figure out what's going on. Everybody else can't. So they're going to have the same dialogue and the same everything. And even if he, like, steps over it, where, like, there's that scene inside the drop ship where he's like, hey, there's something wrong with your suit. There's a dead guy in it. And he ends up saying that, too. So, you know, there's everything's in there. And there's slight variances in there depending on how he reacts to it, like what we just talked about with the blind fight and all that stuff. So, I don't know. Like, I understand what you're saying, but it's part of the world. It's part of the story. It's part of everything that's happening. So it's not a huge deal, and it never like perturbed me at all. I do like one of my favorite things about this movie, though, was the fact that, did you just interrupt me? And then he just goes back into everything that he was saying. The Bill Paxton's character. To where when Tom Cruise's character went ahead and just, like, interrupted him throughout the entire thing, and he just goes back into what he was saying, I liked it, because it just threw a little bit of sass into it.
Yeah, when he's like, yeah, he's working on straight clubs, or no, spades, no clubs. You're going to make him eat them, aren't you?
I did like the fact, like, thanks, asshole. I thought that was a pretty, that was funny.
Let's talk about the creature design, because I really enjoyed the creature design. They were weird and spastic and completely alien, hive mind, and I like that when you killed them, they, like, died and became, like, immovable, like, sculptures of rock or dirt or whatever they were, or I don't know, it was cool.
Didn't it feel a little bit like the squiddies in The Matrix, though? Just a little bit?
A little bit, I guess, but they weren't. There wasn't like one bulbous thing and a bunch of tentacles. It was just kind of like, I don't know. These were more animal than the squiddies. Maybe that's just because I know the squiddies are not animal.
Well, yeah, and they were wild all the way through. And what I actually really, really liked is just some of the different effects on them. Like the alpha had that blue glow. Most of the other ones did have just kind of like they looked kind of like they're lava from the inside out, which I really liked. And then the thing that always got me was the training facility that she's in, and just the way that the creatures move, and the way that these huge fan blades move too. Like that's such a, like a cool way to try to train yourself on these unpredictable movements, because it's not anything like we've ever seen before. So I'm sure that they were getting their asses kicked the entire time, and now we're just like, oh well, we can just put this stuff together. So it was a cool like ingenuity part of it that I actually appreciated. And overall, you know, those things with all the different things that they can do, because it looks like they could like kind of morph a little bit and go and dig into sand, come out, fuck everybody up,
right, bury themselves.
Yeah, it was just a really, really cool design for them, and I think it's still a different kind of creature.
They kind of were like the T-1000, right? Where they could make their appendages do anything in any direction, and they could also shoot the red lava-y shit or whatever, the fireballs, and I don't know. It's something we don't really see, and it was just fun to have them be flailing around out there.
I know. I like. I also like the fact that they burrow. That they're diggers. That it's not just on this beach. Like what they'll do is they'll burrow and they'll dig and then they'll basically entrench themselves.
Like hibernate.
I don't know if they really hibernate. It's just like they're waiting. Like again, kind of almost like I know that I've gone back to this a few times, but Vietnam, where you'll use trenches and these burrows and kind of move around underground so that no one can see your movement, but at the same time they'll set up entrenchment and like mortars and fire on ships, even though it looks like nothing's going to happen. Like when they go into Paris, even though we kind of knew that this is their jam on the beach, but like you think you're, because there was a moment even on this last screening where I'm thinking, man, this is way too quiet. You know, they should be fighting right. You know, because you know they're right up, right. They're coming right after their mothership, and I don't. I completely forgot the fact that they just wait for you to get to a position where they got you in a crossfire, and then shoot your shit down.
And I also thought too, it was because they didn't expect anyone to come there. They knew that they were trying to lure them someplace else. They didn't figure out to get the location, you know, so they're attacking everybody, the main American or the main world forces. So why not only leave a handful of people or, you know, defenders, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Here's a question I have, though, now that we're getting to this finale. Why didn't the alphas think to themselves, oh, crap, they found our location. Shoot one of us in the head. Let's reset this thing and reestablish ourselves somewhere else. Like, well, why didn't they use the same trick that Blunt and Cage have been using throughout this movie?
That's a good question. I mean, that the smaller ones are expendable, so why would it not know? I don't know. Maybe if you kill an alpha, it hurts it a lot more, so it doesn't. I don't know.
Yeah, I think. I think to my understanding that the alphas are finite and it's the omega that actually resets it, because it's the omega that actually has the time powers. Ability. Yeah. So what they'll do is try to reset it to that time where maybe that alpha is still alive, but that's like all that it can go back to.
Yeah. But what I'm saying,
I think the power gets taken, because what they were talking about is that the alpha or the Omega couldn't go back in time because Tom Cruise's character took that alpha's power or that connection to it. There was something with the blood, and I don't exactly remember, but they do talk about it in the movie where they weren't able to go back in time anymore, but they can, the Omega can now send you those visions and fuck with you that way, because that you are a part of kind of the neural network.
Yeah, and but by this particular point, that he was no longer part of that network, though.
When he got the blood transfusion.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. Maybe because that one alpha was already dead. Nope. Like there's got to be something with that. But movie makes dumb sense. So let's have fun.
Well, no, I mean, have y'all ever seen the pitch meetings series on YouTube? The guy who talks to him, like, when I know that I throw that out there, but at the same time I'm just hearing that guy go, because I need the movie to end, like okay, that I mean again that's perfectly valid. I'm just like thinking to myself all these things about this movie, maybe even too hard. This isn't destroying my feeling about the movie, because it still holds up, it still holds its own logic. But at the same time, though, I'm just thinking to myself, well, I mean, if it were me, I would probably would have, you know, killed one of my alphas, have them send a message back, you know, back in time, letting them know, oh my goodness, they know where we are. We need to move this thing, like, ASAP. But, or it would have been even cooler, like, if it turned out that they were in the process of actually, like, getting it moved, and they just, so, you know, at the very end. But, yeah, whatever. It is the movie that it is, but... I don't know. It just makes you think, right?
Well, all these time dilation and shit movies make me think, so I definitely enjoy pondering on the what ifs as well.
Oh, look, I've gone cross-eyed. All right, so we're now, since we're talking about the ending, I got to ask though, did the ending's happy finale aspect feel like it was earned, or do you feel like they added, like, that last bit, you know, when he goes back in time, that was basically kind of there to please audiences? Do you feel like that was, should have been the ending that they got, or that you know, that Cage finally accepted? Because his arc throughout the entire movie was that he was afraid to give of himself what he was willing others to give for him. And so he giving his life to end this Omega should have, you know, wouldn't that have been a more powerful ending if it ended with him as the hero that way? Or do you think or did you want everyone to live, which, let's be honest here, this is a movie that technically ends with everyone living at the end.
Yeah, I mean, it is a little bit of a cop-out, but I don't really mind it, because at that point in time, you've seen him die so many times. He's given, like he says when he deserts that day, I've given more than most. I should be long dead by now. And he did it when he actually had no more lives to give, right? And we've established that the Omega or whatever, they all have time powers, some type of time dilation. Well, he blows that puppy up, it kills everybody, and he gets a whole bunch of time dilated blood all over him. So why not one last happy ending reset to early in the day, you know? I mean, it is a little bit on the nose, but at that point in time, yeah, I didn't want to see him die anymore.
Like, I'm tired of him dying for me.
Right.
Like, let him live.
Well, it also does kind of set up a little bit for a potential sequel when we look at that, because they have the war's not over, you know, that there's more to it. They're talking about going to the Western Front and kicking off that way. So there's going to be more to it. And definitely these two characters have completely earned whatever kind of break that they hopefully will get. You know, and for her, she might not actually get a break. So because it was reset, now they have to go ahead and then just go into a different theater of war at this point. So I don't know. It was kind of like a that's the only thing that I remember from it. It's like, oh yeah, this is nice. Like, it's cool that they rekindled, kind of. Like, you think that's what it's going to be. It's cool that, like, he can see her, and he's like, oh yeah, this is fantastic. You're alive, I'm alive. Beautiful. But shit's going to still hit the fan here in a little bit, because then they just have to move to a different part of the world and basically do it all over again.
Well, so do maybe. They, like, try to capture one and kill it above both of them? I mean...
Well, the thing is, we don't know if there's more than one asteroid that hit. It almost kind of makes it, or made it kind of appear that it was only that one asteroid, and that killing this kind of ended the threat for the most part. Although, I guess it's still kind of open to interpretation on that part. That said, though, I don't know. There's just something about this ending that I feel like, I get what you're saying. And yeah, I guess, you know, for the most part, if it didn't have this happy ending, then it probably would not, it would have earned the box office bomb, because, you know, how audiences love seeing their heroes die at the end, especially when it's Tom Cruise, because, again, he'll never die, right? I mean, at the apocalypse, it'll be Tom Cruise, Mick Jagger, and a cockroach.
Probably.
And I my odds are not on the cockroach. But seriously, though. That said, though, I guess that what I do appreciate about it is that, yeah, he survived. Everyone lived. Even Blunt. But at the same time, that relationship is over. That she doesn't know him. And, I mean, he could probably tell her everything. But the thing is that she's a different person than the person that, you know, that he kind of fell in love with, or that fell in love with him, I guess you could say, during those other times. And so the question at that particular point is, where could they go with that sequel? Because they're making the sequel, that they've already announced it. They even gave it the title. Does anyone know the title?
Yeah, Live, Die, Repeat, Repeat.
Like... they obviously decided to keep the better title and then dumb it up a little bit.
Edge of Yesterday? Edge of Day After Tomorrow?
Right.
I mean, come on.
Well, yeah.
Yeah, that would be a weirder one, Edge of Day After Tomorrow. So mm-hmm. just pull the two disaster movies together. That'll be great. Yeah.
Exactly.
Well, they do fit together to an extent. I mean... I guess when it comes to this title, they're screwed anyway they go with it. I guess that this is probably the best of a bad situation. But where could they go with that? What would you like to see happen in that sequel?
I just want it to be half as entertaining as this, to be honest.
Yeah, it's gotta have the same kind of high octane energy throughout the entire time, right? And you gotta, I don't know plot wise what they could really do. I guess, like I was saying, you know, since you're going to a different theater or war, you could have the same people come in, same kind of characters with him and Blunt's character, and they can try to rekindle some of that. Or you know, she could be sent somewhere and he could be still sent to the front line after him trying to, like, convince the general of everything else that's going on. Mm-hmm. I don't know. Because I think it would be interesting to see... I don't want it to be just, like, duplicated. And that's what I'm worried about. Like, I don't want it to be repeat and repeat. You know, I don't want it to be Tom Cruise and just another badass chick that's fighting all these aliens.
I think Emily Blunt's coming back, too, if I'm not correct.
Okay, so that would be cool if they kind of rekindle that relationship. And, you know, since she's been the same thing that he has been, I'm sure that that's going to be a quick conversation to get her up to speed of everything that has happened. But I don't know. It's going to be a fine line that they have to walk. You know, you can't just redo the same story over again.
I think that's my problem here. Like, when I heard about the sequel, I understand why, because Hollywood, but I honestly felt like, no, don't, let's just leave it as it is. Come on, make it a really nice one shot, and let's just leave it at that, because I feel like at this particular point, it'll either have to be reductive and basically do the exact same thing that the first one did, maybe throw in a few extra action sequences, but it's not going to really go any further. There's not much territory you could go with this unless you decide to take it off of Earth and have it to where, the humans are taking the fight to the aliens and maybe make the humans the bad guys. Maybe. But I don't know. Even that doesn't sound like it would really work. So either they have a super awesome script that's going to blow everybody away, Terminator 2 style, or it's basically setting itself up to fail again. And I feel like, one failure is enough for this movie. This movie deserved so much better, and I'm glad that it now is considered to be an action. It's going to be one of the most well-known action movies of the 2010s. It simply is going to be that, and it deserves that. But at the same time, though, I don't want it to get watered down by a bad sequel. I mean, we already had one Independence Day Resurgence. We don't need another.
Right. Do you know if McQuarrie is coming back to help write this?
I believe that anything that Tom Cruise does, he has Christopher McQuarrie on standby.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. Because I mean, I've loved all the latest Mission Impossible stuff, and if they can kind of keep some of the quality of those plus the first Edge of Tomorrow into a sequel, it's gonna be a home run. You have great actors with a great writer, and then if you still have the same director too, or hell, if McQuarrie comes in and just directs it, that might even be better. You just see crazy practical stunts and it'll be even better.
Maybe, but at the same time, Christopher McQuarrie was also responsible for the two Jack Reacher movies too.
Yeah.
Which weren't horrible. I mean, they were popcorn set. Well, the first one anyways was popcorn Saturday afternoon. Don't take it too seriously, and it's ass kicking and stuff, you know.
It was a prolonged NCIS episode.
Yeah, it's just a middle-aged man punching other people in the face, so whatever.
All right. So, at this point, is there anything else that we want to talk about regarding this movie before we go ahead and get into Geek Sheet?
I think I put a fork in most of my notes.
Yeah, I'm good.
All right. So, Geek Sheet, basically, we're just going to go over the geeky things that we know that this cast and crew have done. Just got to say, Tom Cruise, Mission Impossible, Top Gun. I know that we were supposed to get another Top Gun movie this year. It looks like it might not come out before Mission Impossible 8 at this point. But Tropic Thunder, which, honestly, come on, let's be honest here, that's one of the best cameos ever in a movie, right? I mean, he totally owned Les Grossman.
Yeah, that's the movie that actually got me back on board with Tom Cruise, because it was just something completely out of nowhere, and I was like, holy shit, that's amazing. And then I wanted to see him do like more weird stuff, but all this action shit that he's been doing is just fine with me too.
Just as long as he doesn't break his neck in space, that's all I'm saying.
Or shatter his ankle again.
Yeah. Right.
Oh my god, I can't even watch that scene anymore without wincing. And the criminally underrated Oblivion. I feel like Oblivion is extremely underrated. It's not the best Tom Cruise movie, but I feel like he doesn't get enough credit for that one. But Emily Blunt, Mary Poppins, Quiet Place is usually the go-tos. I know that there's a whole bunch of Devil Wears Prada fans out there. I don't know who you are, and I don't want to know you quite. but yeah, I mean, she's earned herself a reputation. Are y'all excited about Quiet Place 2, out of curiosity?
Absolutely. I thought Quiet Place 1 was one of the best movies I'd seen in years, just because of the, like, environment and the tone and the lack of sound. I'd never seen or heard anything like that. And it was, yeah, I'm ready for the next one. I don't care. I'm a little afraid with what they're doing. There was first reports when there were talk about a second, a sequel, that it would be more like following other farms or other fires during that same time when he crawled up on top of his grain silo and lit the fire. There were many fires in the distance, mm-hmm. and they were supposed to follow them. I might have liked that better than her rolling with the family out in the open, but I like post-apocalyptic, and this could be cool.
What about you, Chris? Are you excited for A Quiet Place 2?
For sure. I'm stoked. You know, I think also letting her hopefully lead the whole movie is going to be even better, mm-hmm. just because we've seen everything that she can do acting-wise. Mm-hmm. And, you know, having a baby in the middle of a fucking apocalypse like that already, and then having to defend said baby against these crazy ass creatures, I think that's going to be really, really fun. I'm nervous that they're going to make it a little bit like a Walking Dead thing, where mm-hmm. it could go to where it's really the humans that are the assholes, and that's not what, right? But that's not what I want that this franchise to go through. I want more crazy monsters, and I want that threat to always be there from an outside force like that, rather than just more melodrama between humans just being dicks to each other.
So you don't want The Last of Us 2, is that what you're saying? All right.
I mean...
Too soon? All right. Oh, go ahead. I didn't mean to...
No, you're good. I think I've just seen it before. I want them to go in a different direction. And if we're going to just repeat The Walking Dead or Last of Us, you know, that's cool, I guess, but they can do better.
I will see. That said, I've already gone over Bill Paxton's career so many times on the show. I'm going to tell you something that I just found out that just makes me love him even more, if you don't mind. Bill Paxton, in 1980, before he even met James Cameron, wrote and directed one of the first Saturday Night Live digital shorts or film shorts at the time. I did not know that. Like, he actually got a piece on Saturday Night Live back in the heyday, back when in Eddie Murphy's first season. That just blows my mind. Like, knowing that just made me rethink everything. I mean, you know, I loved his directorial movies, specifically Frailty. B, please tell me you've seen Frailty. Please tell me you've seen Frailty.
I have not.
Oh, dude, you gotta see it. And whatever you do, do not let anyone tell you anything about the movie. Going completely blind. Do not know anything. You will love the movie more the less you know going in. But it may or may not be an episode of Art House Legends pretty soon, so just keep that in mind.
Nice.
But Brendan Gleeson, I mean, Mad-Eye Moody, everyone loves to talk about In Bruges. I don't know why, specifically.
That's a good movie.
I understand, I got on our episode, I got reamed out for not being the biggest In Bruges fan ever. So that's kind of an inside joke with this. But yes, I love Brendan Gleeson. He's one of my favorite actors. But he's got a geek sheet on him. Noah Taylor, the scientist who was the one who developed the technology to fight off the aliens, he's most well known for working on Almost Famous. He was the manager, the band manager, in Almost Famous, and which is one of my all time favorite movies. So I had to throw that in there. And then, of course, Doug Liman, director, Born Identity, Jumper, Mr. and Mrs. Smith, Swingers, which is an episode we've done here. Go. Come on, please tell me that someone's seen Go. I feel like that is one of the most underappreciated 90s movies ever.
I probably have. I got bad memory, dude.
All right. Yeah. Think of it as Pulp Fiction for millennials. That's the best way to put it. But yeah, if you get a chance, check it out. It's awesome. And I have to throw in just one last bit of bad news, because there was a notorious individual, who was a producer on this movie. Our very own Secretary of the Treasury, Steven Mnuchin, was one of the producers on this movie. Mr., you're not going to get your checks on time type thing. So yeah. So raspberries to you, my friend.
Well, I was trying to remember where I saw Noah Taylor before, and he plays Hitler in Preacher, the TV show. So that's another piece if you want to just kind of coincide what you're talking about. And I was trying to place him real hard in my mind, and I was like, I can't get it. And then I looked him up, and I was like, oh, that he looks a lot different with that kind of mustache rather than just a little guy.
Yeah, the thing is that I've seen Almost Famous 30 times. If you doubt me, go watch our episode on Almost Famous. So that's whenever I think of Noah Taylor, that's how I think of him. I can't think of him as anything else. He'll always be that guy from Almost Famous. But
he'll always be Hitler to me.
Well, hats off. All right, so at this point, let's go ahead and let's call it. Chris, Beef, do you agree with the critics and audiences on Live, Die, Repeat, Edge of Tomorrow? Do you give it a pass? Do you give it a fail? Or do you give it a maybe? Beef.
I got to give it a pass. A pass. I don't know if they said they liked it or if it took them too long to realize that it was a good movie, but I went and saw it right away. I enjoyed the shit out of it, and I've been converting people to go see whatever movie is named, you know, or whatever the hell this movie is named. And, you know, I bought it on two separate streaming accounts, one that I share with a friend just so him and his family could watch it because I like it that much.
Chris.
It's a big pass for me. I loved it. And watching it for this one just made me appreciate all the little things that they do so well. Just the fact that they can balance out all the action beats plus actually have a compelling story and amazing actors, top tier actors. It's fantastic.
And as I mentioned before, this is, in my opinion, the second best action movie of the 2010s, only being beat out by The Raid 2. And anyone who knows about the Raid movies and how awesome those are, you know that that's a high standard. So this is absolutely a pass, a true action classic. I feel like this is a movie that is going to get more attention and more love as it gets older. I don't know if the sequel will have any impact on how this movie is appreciated, but even if it is a complete turkey, we still got this one. And this one works so well on its own, you could just completely forget that anything else exists. But yes, absolute pass. So thank you so much, gentlemen, for showing me for this episode. Beef, where can people find you on the internet?
You could find me at legendspodcast.com. I also do a couple other side shows, expansiveopa.podbean.com and westworldweekly.com.
Chris, where can people find you on the internet?
I do my own show called Ambition Radio, where I interview people who have found some kind of balance between their life, family, career, and the pursuit of their passions, dreams, or hobbies. I'm on the Facebooks. I'm on the Instagrams. you can find me there at Ambition Radio Podcast. Hit me up. I'm always looking for more stories and different voices to share.
And if you're wanting more awesomeness from Art House Legends, you can go onto our website, arthouselegends.libsyn.com, or you can go onto any place where you get your podcasts, such as Apple's iTunes Store. You can go onto Stitcher, Spotify, iHeartRadio. You know the places to go. We have our YouTube channel, Art House Legends. You can go onto Facebook if you want to join the Facebook gang. on there. If you have Twitter, at Arthouse Legends, or if you just want to send us a really awesome letter letting us know that you think we are the best podcast on the internet, you can do so at arthouselegends@gmail.com, and I will get right back to you shortly. Gentlemen, thank you so much for joining me for this episode. This is the Movie Dude Air.
This is Chris Tondeville.
And this is Beef.
And pick up your stuff before leaving to drive it.